momentarily. And good morning to everybody. Today we're going to be addressing one of the readings of Passover. We have an eight-day holiday, and even during the intermediary days, we read the Torah. And there was one section that had caught my eye, and I thought we'd take it up, just about three or four verses. And we'll start just in a moment. Our friends will be calling in. And once you hear the audio feed, just please type audio okay at the bottom of your screen. That'll give us confirmation that you're picking up the audio fine. So again, once you hear the audio feed, just please type audio okay at the bottom of your screen and click send. And again, if there's any during the class itself, we'll pause for any questions or comments, and you'll be able to communicate with us by just typing them in at the bottom too. And again, we'll start just one moment. Okay, D in Atlanta, thank you. Mayor Phil, Rick Susan in Seattle, thank you so much. Okay, it looks like the audio is fine. So as soon as the friends call in from Seattle, we'll start. And what we'll take up today are a few verses in Exodus. It's Exodus 22, chapter 22, verses 27 through 30. Okay, Rezora, thank you. Hope everything's good. I got your message. I wrote you back. So we'll talk after the class today. And again, if there's any part of the class that you missed, we always record the classes and place them on the audio page and also the new postings page, just so you can listen to them at a later point. Okay, Rezora, thank you. And Yafet in Canada, thank you. Thank you. free to take a look at Exodus 22, chapter 22, verses 27 through 30. And the question that we're going to start with is, what is the relationship between all those verses? And Avi in North Carolina, thank you for the confirmation. Good morning.
Good morning, Rabbi. How are you doing?
Hey, Doug. How are you?
I'm good. I apologize for being late. We're having technical phone difficulties here for some reason.
That's okay.
Can you pause for just a moment? I've been unable to get our conference people on the line.
Sure, go ahead. I already just mentioned to the people online what the subject matter that we're doing, so I left them with the first question for now, and we'll wait until you're all hooked up. Go ahead.
Okay. Sorry. Thanks.
No problem. Okay, so while we're waiting, just read in case you don't have the verses in front of you. The issue, this was actually read on the second day of the intermediary days of Passover, the Torah reading, and this is just a portion of it, but it's something which is bracketed off, which means that in the Torah, when you have either a gap of spaces between words, before and after a certain series of verses, so that gap is to indicate that that is it's sectioning off as its own encapsulated area. And that means all the text, the verses in that area, have to be pointing to a consistent theme. That means it's one theme. So the theme that we're dealing with, again, is Exodus 22, chapter 22, verses 27 to 30, and I'll read them for you. It states that a prince or a judge should not be, you should not curse. That's the first one.
Rabbi, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And Brad, Mary, are you there?
Yes, we're here.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay, good.
Thank you, Rabbi. Sorry again for the delay.
No problem. Okay. So, we're just going over the verses. Right now, we're taking up the Torah reading that we had on the second intermediary day of Passover, and there was just a few verses that caught my attention, and we'll see if we can answer what the relevance is to Passover. But first, I'd just like to understand why these four verses are isolated as being their own theme. And I was just explaining that we know that certain verses in the Torah have their own encapsulated theme. If we see that in the Torah's text there is a gap of about nine letters before and after a certain section, that means we know God is indicating that that section that was preceded by a gap and concludes with a gap of letters means to say that that is sectioned off as its own theme. So that means all verses in that area would have to have some common ground. And the verses we're referring to again is Exodus 22, verses 27 to 30. So the first verse I was just reading says that either God or a judge, you should not curse, and a prince of your people, you should not cast any curses on. That's the first verse. Second verse is that the first fruits and the truma, which is the tithes, you should not delay, and also the firstborn of your sons, you should give to God. And that means that not only the firstborns are to be dedicated to temple service, but we redeem them from the priest by giving him a certain number of coins. And that redeems the son back to us. So that also you should not delay. Right, so the first verse is talking about cursing either a leader, a prince, a judge. A second verse is talking about not delaying to give your tithes, your first of your crop, your first child to be redeemed. You shouldn't delay doing that. And similarly, it says in verse 29, so also you should do to your oxen, to your sheep. 7 days they should be with its mother, and the eighth day, then you give it to God. Again, that's talking about the same idea as the previous verse. That means that on the seventh, you keep it for 7 days, I guess, until it has the stability of life, because it was just born. Then it's fit to give to God. But don't delay. Again, the concept here is not to delay. And the last verse in our series of verses says that a holy people, or a sanctified people, you should be to me. And that's substantiated by the statement that a animal that you found killed in the field, which, I mean, it wasn't killed by slaughter. So any animal that's not killed by slaughter, a Jew can't eat. So God is saying the way you'll be sanctified is if you find any animal killed in the field, that's trepha. Trepha means that it's torn, which means that it was killed, it was gored, it was attacked by a lion. You cannot eat it, but to your dog you should cast it. You should give it to your dog to eat. Okay, so it seems very disconnected when we first read this. What is the relationship? So take a few moments and take a look at the verses and just let them sink in and see what the significant issues are. And let's see if we can find what the common ground is over here. And again, if anybody is joining us online and has any idea, you can type down the screen. And we'll take a few moments and take a look at the verses. Again, it's Exodus 22, verses 27 through 30. Seems disconnected. Let's take the first verse. The first verse says, a prince or a judge, you should not curse in your people. Now, what's the first thing we have to ask when we look at a verse like that? Let's just isolate that one verse. And what would our response or comments be regarding in connection to that verse? By the way, Doug, I had a question for you. If other people wanted to join in on the phone, does that cost more for every additional person?
No, it's just simply a long-distance call for them, and we can accommodate, I think, up to 100. So all we need is their email address, and we can put them on the list and send them all the contact information.
Okay, so what I'm going to do, I'm going to just do that now, if that's okay with you, and just let the people who are online right now, and maybe we'll include that in the next email.
They can call in now if they want.
Uh-huh. What's the number? If somebody wants to call in now, what's the number? If they...
is 620.
Right.
782.
Right.
8800. And their participant access code is 713613.
713613. Okay, I'll put that on the screen. We just put on screen a number if anybody wants to call in. This way you can interact with words also. So compliments of Doug and Cal Taylor. You can call in. That is a New York number. So I guess if you're calling outside of New York, excuse me, that's a United States number. So if you're calling outside the United States, so you would have to put in the appropriate prefixes, access codes, country codes, and so on. I think only Canada and New York, Canada and the United States can access that direct. Okay. So the number's on the screen. All right. So it's an interesting verse, right? I mean, what would be the first question we'd ask about the prohibition to curse a judge or prince of the people?
I might ask the question of why is the verse there? What would cause the people to curse judges or princes of the people?
Right, exactly. Why would you want it cursed? And when is a person, well, the I'd follow up and say, well, when is a person in proximity to a judge or a prince? What's the occasion?
It's probably a dispute situation or some situation where there's some argument taking place.
Okay, so now you can answer your question.
So they may end up not getting the judgment that they want, and therefore they may be angry, and therefore they may be prone to curse the judge.
Right, exactly. Okay. Now, and Dee in Atlanta is just asking, isn't there a concept of not cursing anyone? Why are we just singling out a judge and a prince? So no, there is a specific prohibition just for these people, for your parents, for God, and for the leaders of the people. So it's just to them.
Well, there is a prohibition against cursing your neighbor, for example?
I'm not aware of one.
Okay. And am I correct that cursing your neighbor does not halakhically fall under the definition of blasphemy?
Yes, that's right. We're not talking about blasphemy.
Right, okay.
I guess a curse here we're talking about that you mock you some sort of a degrading statement.
Rabbi?
Yes, go ahead.
In a situation like this, the judge is God's representative on earth. So if you're cursing the judge, you're cursing God. And so you have to remember when you're in a situation like that where you're at, and not let your emotions overtake you.
Well, I wouldn't say that, because since we have a separate prohibition not to curse God, so that would seem to be its own independent act, where this would be distinct from cursing God. So this would be not considered an act. Although one of the commentaries does say that this is referring to God. So there is one commentary that just says, that says here, that when it says the word Elohim, sometimes the word Elohim means a judge, and then sometimes Elohim means God. It's the same exact word. So you'd be...
Well, I thought in situations like this, sometimes they did refer to the judges as God, because they're sitting, they have the power of God, and they're supposed to be guided by God, so... You need to show them due respect.
Okay. Let's read the next verse and see if you can see some sort of a parallel. Let's keep it in the context, because we tend to just look at the one verse and not the context. We may lose sight of the theme. That's what we're really trying to do, is to get the theme over here. The next verse says that you should not delay giving your first of the crop, which is bikurim. That's a law that when you the first crop of your tree, you have to give to God. And also the truma, the tithes, the regular tithes, lo ta'acher. That the verse says do not delay. Interesting. It doesn't say don't hold it back. It says do not delay. That means you're going to give it, but you're just going to give it later. Even that you can't do. So that's pointing to something. All right, as well, you have to do the same with the firstborn and with the oxen and with the sheep. It goes on in verse 29.
Rabbi, it seems like there is a concept in here about respect for authority.
Okay, so if I asked you what the last verse had to do with that, you probably wouldn't like me too much, right?
No, that's the one where I can't make that one fit.
Yeah. You're right, I would agree with that statement. I would agree with that statement, and that authority definitely is one of the factors here.
If I were to try to tie it into the last verse, when it says, you know, be holy to me, be holy people to me, it seems like the theme might be recognize what your position is and act in accordance with that. That you're a special people, chosen by me, you have obligations, and obligations that relate to, you know, my authority.
Right. It would seem arbitrary then to have these. I mean, I could have thought of a number of things to put in here if authority was targeted. Now, I just mentioned also that in a series of verses, the theme can be continuous, even though, let's say, if you're here, the last verse is not talking about giving anything to God or cursing a judge. Here it's just talking about that if you find a dead animal in the field, right, you can't eat it, but give it to your dog. It's a funny type of thing. There's two things. You can't eat it, and this is going to make you sanctified, plus you also have to give it to your dog. What is that? But it could very well be that that's part of a theme. You could have a theme where you have a couple of verses that are dealing with the issue, and then the last verse or another verse might be dealing with how its response, how the response is to the first two. And that very well entitles it to be part of the theme. A theme doesn't mean that every single verse is trying to target the same point. You could have a number of verses that are addressing the issue, that are giving you a panoramic view of certain expressions in different situations, and then the last verse can be how God addresses that if it's a flaw, and then it qualifies it as being part of it, because now it's, you have the problem and you have the solution all in one set area in the Torah. So we could think of it being part of a theme in that respect too. Now let me ask you a question. Let's go a step further here. A person, like you were saying, Doug, a person goes to, and again, let me just repeat one more time for people who just joined. There is the last entry in red on your screen is a number you can call in and an access code if you want to join the class live, I mean verbally. You can still type questions in, but if you want to be able to ask questions, you have that ability just to dial that number. Okay, does that number change each week or stays the same, Doug?
It generally stays the same, although if people want to be continuously involved, it would be great if they emailed us so we can put them on the list, because we send out a weekly reminder, and if the number changes, then they'll get that.
Okay, so what I'll do is I'll for this coming Sunday when I do the email. We'll put all the information in there. We'll put an email where they can click to you and let you know, and then you can respond to them with the information.
That'd be great.
Okay. By the way, this week I didn't get a confirmation email from you. Like an invite.
I wondered why I didn't get a response from you.
Yeah, I see one. And unless I got lost, I got like a ton of junk mail over the first 2 days of the holiday. I came back, there was about 200 spams, so.
Oh.
I'm not sure if I got lost in the shuffle there. Yeah, but if you don't hear from me, we just, you know, that means we're on. So just as a general rule, if that happens again.
Okay, thank you.
I'll definitely, you know, contact you if I can.
Look at your talk live thing to see when the next one class is, and so I knew that you were having this.
Oh, good, good. Yeah, so we're saying over here that a person will curse the judge, he'll be in a court case, he doesn't like the outcome, so he curses him. He puts him down. Why does he do that? He's frustrated, right? He wanted it to go a certain way. So what is this telling us about this person, as well as the person in the next verse who delays giving his first of his crop and his tithes? He delays. He gives it, but he delays. What picture is this painting for us?
Rabbi?
Yes.
It seems like the common theme here is that that type of a person is thinking of themselves first. And I think the whole theme of all of this is to think of God first. Since God created everything, everything has to come. God has to come first.
Well, you're following the decision of the judge. I mean, he's telling you you've got to pay the money, so you stick your hand in your pocket and you give the $100 to the other litigant. And it's just that you're on your way out, you curse the judge. So you're actually following the law. And so what additional objective is being targeted over here? Also, you're giving the first of your crop, you're just not giving it a dime.
Is it possible that the subsequent verses follow from the first one? So if I got a judgment that I didn't like, and on the way out I make some disparaging remark about the judge, then I go home and I say, yeah, okay, I got to do this first fruit thing. I'll get to it later. And I'm basically letting my emotions keep me from being scrupulous about attendance to the requirements of the law.
Okay, good. Which emotion?
Probably anger and frustration.
Well, where does that come from?
The judge. Well,
no. No. Don't blame the judge for this one, Doug.
Well, my reaction to the judgment.
Okay, and well, your action is generated from what?
I didn't get what I wanted.
Okay, you didn't get what you wanted. Right. That's what I would say as well. What's going on here in both cases is that there are certain events that didn't transpire as I wished. I went to court because I saw the facts a certain way, and that is really my objective was to see. When you go to court, there could be one of two objectives. Well, what are the two possible objectives a person might have going to court? And just Elaine is just writing on screen that we have to follow rules. We're talking about the type of person. That's true, Elaine, but it's a general statement. We're trying to really pinpoint what the specific message is over here. So what are the two possibilities when I go to court, how I can approach the case?
Well, one would be that I want a certain outcome.
Right.
For me. Another might be I want a certain outcome for the other guy.
Okay, then
I want to a particular monetary award to come in my direction, or I want this guy to be punished.
Okay, then there's a third one. Then I'll have to update my statement. I stand corrected.
Okay. Rabbi?
Yes.
Well, based upon how a lot of modern court cases go, it's to delay the inevitable. In other words, if I know I'm going to have to pay somebody $1 million, and if I tying it up in court, I can delay it by 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 years, that $1 million is still in my pocket.
Well, that's still subsumed under Doug's first case, where you want it to be your way. That's really just an expression of how you can get things your way, right?
I took it when Doug said my way is that I don't owe the $1 million at all.
Okay.
Whereas in this case, I'm saying I know I owe the $1 million. I know I'm wrong. But if I tie it up in court long enough, it's going to delay when I'm going to have to pay it.
Right, but that's still just another expression of how a person wants to have things his way.
True.
Either I want it all or I don't want to give it right away. That's one thing, you know, which I agree 100%. The second way Doug was saying is that it's just more of a vindictive emotion. You want to see the other person punished. There's a third possibility when a person goes
Rabbi?
To the... Yeah.
Rabbi Gitch, first of all, like some math.
Take some math.
This is Bill.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Excuse me?
I just said hi. How are you?
Oh, fine. Thank you, Rabbi. When a person goes to court, ultimately, doesn't that person go there with the idea that they want justice? You know, in other words, they want justice done, correct?
Well, that was my third possibility. In the first case, Doug was saying that he doesn't want justice. He wants to win, or he wants the other person to lose. You're giving the third possibility. He wants justice. And that should then be whatever comes out of the judge's mouth.
So that was my comment anyway.
Right, so you were saying that that's really what the person should be doing.
Well, that's what he should. I mean, if he's being honest and objective, I mean, that should be his ultimate goal. And based on the ruling of the particular judge, if the judge is fair and impartial and unbiased, then he's going to rule justly, and then the person who receives that verdict should be content with whatever decision the judge has rendered.
Right, exactly.
And then he should be satisfied, and then he can continue on with the performance of mitzvahs and whatever. But this is almost an extension of if a person goes to court and he feels that an injustice has been done by the nasi or the leader among the people, then his next slippery slope is that he begins to delay in the performance of the mitzvahs. In other words, he begins to slack off in regarding keeping the mitzvahs instead of doing it in a timely fashion.
Right. So the right approach, the correct approach, is where the person is not looking at his own pocketbook or looking at, you know, penalizing the other person. He recognizes, like you're saying, just to elaborate, when the person goes to court, he realizes there's a dispute. He has a right to present his case. That's what a fair system is, where both voices can be heard, and you have a mutual arbiter that would be intelligent and examine the cases, and if he doesn't have all the facts, he relies on witnesses and interrogates them to make sure that the second-hand knowledge is being extracted as accurate and honestly as possible. And the objective of a really true person who's trying to follow God's system is that he looks at the overall picture, that justice and fair play must exist in the world. And like Dee in Atlanta is just writing on screen, and Elaine, they're making comments about Dee is saying that the person should want a just decision. Exactly. And Elaine is just mentioning that justice is subjective. Well, that's what we try to avoid, any type of subjectivity. And if a person is really true about his adherence to the Torah system and he wants there to be a system for the nation, then he is not looking for a specific outcome. And what he is looking for is supporting a system, following the rules, understanding that this is God's wisdom and this is how society will operate the best. The real objective goal should be, of both litigants, is that the system of Torah should be carried out fair for everybody. It doesn't matter whether you win or you lose. You should be looking at the system that's continuing to govern and keep peace in the land. And that should really be what the person wants, because the benefit that he's really going to get for him and everybody else is when the concept of equality is seen. And this is something which, you know, Abraham saw himself without having any teacher, without any guide. He was able to recognize, and that's what he taught other people, because he saw that God didn't create just one person. The fact that there are numerous people on earth means that God's will is that these numerous people should exist. And since they all have the same desires and needs, so Abraham was able to conclude the concept of justice and equality. And God wanted to teach him more about this. That's why he discussed the whole destruction of Sodom and Amorah before he actually commenced the destruction. Okay. So we see here that the expression of a curse, even if you comply with the judge and you give the guy the $1,000, whatever it is the judge is now telling you you must pay, a person might still, even though he complies with the ruling, with the verdict, he may still curse the judge on the way out under his breath. That doesn't mean that the judge has to hear him say it. It just means the act of cursing itself is now a command that God is telling us here in this reading, in this section of the Torah. Because the expression of curse is where a person is giving in to his own subjective wishes. He wants it to go a certain way, and it didn't. So now what he does is he displaces his aggression on the system towards the judge, which is another facet, another nuance if we examine this very delicately, we see that there's a number of issues. One issue is that there's the broad message is accepting reality, looking for exactly what the system that God says should function and follow in the way it functions. If it means that you lose money, you lose. But that you should be happy that you're upholding the system by complying with the rules. But another delicate nuance over here is the fact that I can give the money, but if I curse the judge, I'm doing something very wrong. And that is that I'm now, number one, I'm giving it to my own subjective wishes. Even though I gave the money in action, my internal world still has not changed yet. That's number one. But number two, it's really displacement from God. The person should be really unhappy with God. God's the one that created the system. So why are you cursing the judge? So it's another aspect of where the human frailty is here. So there's two things. The desire to live subjectively, my own desires, my own personal gain. I don't care about somebody else. That's number one. And number two, there's a displacement of the aggression that he has. So God wants a person to be aware of as much as he can about his own personality, his own human nature. And these are, you know, emotions that every single human being has. That's why it can be written in a book that addresses, you know, the entire populace of the world. This is not just a message to one person who's distorted. Everybody has this. Okay. Any other, let me just pause for a second, see if there's any comments or questions. Okay. The next verse states that you shouldn't delay giving the tithes of the first of your crop or redeeming your firstborn son. The same thing with your cattle, your oxen, your sheep. 7 days it remains with the mother until it's independently functioning, and then you give it to God. Then it's fit to give to God, but then don't delay. You should give it on that eighth day. So the concept here, we see clearly, the unique message here is not to delay giving something to God. Okay, so what's your feeling on that? This concept of delaying to give something for a temple worship, or to give something to God, to what you owe of your crops. That's the question. What is the new idea over here? Why does the Torah have to tell me not to delay? I'm giving it, so I'll give it a little bit later. How did the first of the animals I have to give to God?
Rabbi, is it because when you start to delay, then you are stepping down a slippery slope toward sort of not, eventually not giving at all, and that it's very important that you be scrupulous about doing it right away, because if you delay one day, then you can delay 2 days, then 3 days, then a week, then a month, and pretty soon, oh gee, I just forgot completely, no big deal.
According to that, then, it's true that might happen, but according to that, then the delay of one day is not inherently the problem, and it seems to be here that that is the problem. You just missed it by one day, that's it. You violated this law.
Oh, but I would argue that delay one day is the concern, because what it's done is allowed you to start down that slope of not being scrupulous about keeping the law on time.
So then that means the delay itself of that one day is sufficiently corrupt. You don't have to bring in the fact that you might delay a week as being the outcome. This is itself the problem. We don't need to go on to the maybe, you know, you'll come to delay even more. I'm just trying to say that.
Right, but you could ask the question, well, why does a delay of one day hurt?
Right, that's my question.
My answer would be because it sets you up to in a situation where you may eventually not keep the halakha at all.
So that means one day itself inherently is not wrong. You're saying that the real problem is that you will not follow it at all, not giving it late. I'm saying that giving it late itself is the bottom line. Giving it late or not giving it all maybe is the same thing.
Well, okay. I mean, I could be all right. If the speed limit's 55 miles an hour, you're going over the speed limit at 56.
Right.
say, well, gee, does it really make any difference? Well, technically, yes, it does.
Well, technically, in terms of how much money you have to pay if you go 20 miles over or 100 miles over the speed limit, you know, the monetary penalty increases. But the
in the world of halakha, my understanding is you either meet the halakha or you don't.
Exactly.
So if the speed limit were halakha, 55 would be it, and 56, you're out.
Right. Right, so you're out at this point. And Yafet in Canada is agreeing with you. She's saying if you start delaying in one thing, you'll start delaying in other things, like doing your daily prayers, morning and evening and night. So it's true. I'm not doubting that reality, that once you, put one hole in the dam, that's it. You know, it's only a matter of time until the whole dam breaks.
But it sounds like the question you're asking is, why does even the first inch matter in and of itself?
Yes.
And I guess my statement would be because the line in the sand is the day it's due. Sort of like your bank loan.
Okay, well, let's go philosophically now. Because there has to be a real philosophical corruption over here by the person doing this. Even though it seems so minuscule, just one day late. You know, my goodness, well, what's with all this exactitude, you know? Why be so picky you? But what's the motive? Let's look at the human motive to do this. And Elaine is asking that this delay is only, she says, is only an application to the crops, but not to the firstborn. Let's see, it says in the verse, Elaine, that the first crop and the tithes, you should not delay. And the sons of your firstborn sons, you should give to me. All right, could be right, Elaine. Let's just take a moment to see if Rashi addresses that. It's a good point that Elaine is making. Maybe the delay is only talking about the crops, but not about the sons and the animals. That is verse 28. Let's see. One sec. According to Ibn Ezra, the delay also applies to the Bechor. He says that it was properly stated. He doesn't quote who exactly right here. He says it was properly stated that this verse was stated that you should not delay to giving to the poor what you are obligated, and also so also you should do to the in regard to the firstborn, giving it to the priest. So he seems to be saying that delay is applicable across the board here, which makes sense to me because I think you have in other places the law of giving the firstborn. So this can't just be repeating the concept. We already know from another place that you cannot hold the firstborn. You must give the firstborn. Okay. And let me see what Alana's writing. Alana's saying the purpose of a ticket is to change behavior, not for revenue. Let's see. The purpose of one day is like lighting candles. If you're late, you don't do it at all. No, that's not true. You would still give, even if you delay. Okay. So delay seems to be the issue. Why does the person delay? That's the question now.
Well, Rabbi, just regarding the firstborn. I mean, if you have a son and you're to bar, you know, you're supposed to circumcise him on the eighth day. So it doesn't say you should, you know, you can delay and do it on the ninth day or the tenth day or the sixth day or whatever the case may be. It has to be on the eighth day. Is there some kind of an allusion here to covenant responsibilities?
No, he's not talking about circumcision at all. No, this is not referring to circumcision at all.
Okay, so there's no. I guess I'm just. I know it's not directly referring to circumcision. I'm just saying that when one is not serious about obeying what the commandments say to do in this small regard, then it'll be easy not to do what the commandments say to do in a larger sense.
Right. That was what Doug was. That was the approach Doug was using before. This is more of a precursor to a protective or a guarding type of law that, you know, don't make a small hole because then it's just going to get bigger. But the thing itself, the small hole is something, if we can show a negative quality in the small hole itself, that's a better answer, I believe. And we have it seems to be that there is a theme between the first case about cursing and here. And Rick Susan in Seattle is writing that verse 28 says you shall not delay, and verse 29 says it should be on the eighth day. It would seem that the delay includes everything between these two statements. Right, the theme does carry through. It's a good point, Rick. Okay. Why does a person delay?
Rabbi, is it because there might be some attachment to the thing that they're supposed to give?
Right, I would say that exactly. When you delay, it's because you prefer not to do the action. That's the same concept of a procrastinator. Right, we talked about that once, King Solomon, what his response to the procrastinator was. So a procrastinator or a person who delays, is showing that there's a conflict. You give it, but you give it later. Or you tell somebody, yeah, I'll do this, but I'll do it later. This way I can keep on lying on my hammock, sipping my lemonade, and not having to mow the lawn, which is going to take an hour in the hot sun. So I just lay there, and I say, yeah, I'll do it. This way it makes me look good, but I don't have to do the action because I said I'll do it later. So over here, the person is attached to the object. He does not want to part with the animal. So he's giving it late. Again, what does this show you about the person? It's showing you that he is living in a subjective framework where what he wants is the monetary good for himself. Again, just like the first case of cursing, what's the same? What is the theme?
All about me.
Right. It's all about me. It's whatever I want. But you see that it's expressed in two ways. The first way is expressed in terms of what category, and the second way, you tell me, what's the difference between the expression? What two expressions are now being written here? So I would say,
it sounds like, Rabbi, reviling and cursing are the two expressions.
No, I mean to say the expression of wanting the, you know, life to be going in my subjective way. Meaning, in the case of the first case of cursing, is because certain events didn't transpire how I wished. I have a certain outlook. This is giving us an insight into something we all know is true, but it's bringing it to the fore and making us really just stare it in the face and realize that and admit that as we live our lives each day, we do have a certain desire of how this day should unfold. And frustration is when that plan or that outlook of how I'm going to run my day today becomes interrupted by unexpected circumstances.
But Rabbi, isn't that in some sense a denial of God's sovereignty?
When you express it this way, there is nothing wrong with feeling frustration if you wanted to do one thing and something else came up. Frustration is just human, and the question is how you deal with it. But It's something like it is. I hear what you're saying. That you're saying God has control. The only thing is, you don't know that God is the one that caused this interruption in your day right now. You wanted to go shoot a couple of holes of golf, and then ends up that your next door neighbor, the husband's out of town, and the car doesn't work, and the kids got to go to soccer practice, so they call on you. And now it's gonna. Now you're not gonna play golf because it's gonna take you a half an hour there and a half an hour back, and that's it. And your lunch break is over. So this is not God. This is common everyday places where things happen. People make decisions to go out of town. It ends up that the car broke down at the same time. You happen to be a next door neighbor that they know your phone number, and you're the first one they call. And if there's nobody else really around to do this, then you have the obligation to really step in and do it. All right, this is something which is where you're frustrated. It's not God doing it. It's not a matter of God's sovereignty, unless you want to say that since this is really God's will, so then you're accepting that as really what your plan should be, as opposed to your subjective plan to play golf. In that sense, I agree with you 100%. Now, that would apply, though, to every law that you break. I just want to hone in over here on this, you know, to really define the subject matter, the phenomena that we're addressing in specific. We have to give an explanation that will not fit any other question. I mean, if we really want to arrive at what we call a definition of a given verse or a certain theme, it's when we describe it and it cannot fit into anything else. Then we've accurately really brought out into the foreground what the specific law is here. The 613 laws, and the thousands and thousands of nuances and rabbinic laws that are piled on top. But what I always try to do is to see how can we explain this, which would really epitomize this issue. So if I say I'm not deferring to God's sovereignty and I want to live by my own wishes, that would seem to apply to any time I go against any law, right? I'm rejecting God's rule in every case. So what can I say here that's more, that's unique to this phenomenon? When I delay. So even though while it's true it is a denial of God by delaying, there's something else going on here that we want to highlight and be sensitive to. Because human nature is very intricate. And the more we can learn about it, the more we can be in control of these different emotions that are corrupting. So here the person is delaying giving his physical property, right? But he didn't give the animal the right day or the crops. And when he left court, he cursed the judge. Even though he paid him, he gave the money that he was told he had to give, but he still cursed. So in the first case, by the judges, the person is now expressing the frustration with events that didn't go the way he liked. So that's one type of expression where you want, like you were saying, Doug, that your subjective wishes, your own plan, how things have to go in line with my own happiness. This is one expression of how you have to perfect yourself. You do not curse. You accept it. This is the system. This is, look at the big picture. It's trying to take a person out of the subjective wish in terms of events going his way and looking at the system of justice as really being the good. A person is really honest and sees how the Jewish court system works, he should really be happy. If a real perfected person should be happy, even if he had to give $1 million, he should be happy that this system is intact and that justice is something which is preserved and they're intelligent people that are trying to arrive at it. In terms of giving your property, that's now in terms of the monetary. That's in terms of the monetary. I mean, it's showing another expression, another angle, another facet to how a person will play out his day and not be completely devoted to the system, and he's still giving in to his subjective wishes as opposed to abandoning that in place of following exactly what God says is the best thing for you. All right, do we see that?
Yes. Can I ask a question, Rabbi, that's a little bit connected to this, hopefully?
Yeah, good.
Is in verse 28, where it's mentioned that this person may delay in the fullness offering and the priestly heave offerings, and then it follows up by the firstborn of your son shall you present to me. If this person is having difficulty in the area of, for instance, a fullness offering or a heave offering, when it comes to an argument from the lesser to the greater, is he going to be totally unwilling to comply when it comes to his own son?
Well, I would certainly guess that he'd have more difficulty there. But here it's just telling that he has to redeem him. He gives a certain number of coins to, and this is only the firstborn son, it doesn't apply to any other one. So he has to give a certain number of coins to the priest to demonstrate that he's now, really the son does have a designation to be in temple, but I'm redeeming him with X number of coins, and now he's going to stay in my house like all the rest of my kids will.
Okay.
And so, Rabbi, we talked a little earlier about the person may have a certain attachment to something, but in the case of the firstborn son, that doesn't seem to fit here, because just the fact that I need to go, you know, give some coins to redeem him doesn't mean I'm going to lose him. You know, if I have to give the first fruits of my produce and they're the most beautiful and so forth, I might be reluctant because I'm going to lose them, but I'm not going to lose the son.
Well, I'd say two things. You do have to forfeit money right now, but there's something a little bit more subtle going on here. And that is that if I have a son and I'm told I've got to redeem him, that, you know, it suggests to me that I don't have full rights over my own child. That's something which is another angle in terms of mine, the area of what's mine, you know, the childhood. Kids, the first word kids learn is mine. That's my toy. That's a very powerful emotion, and that's something which, you know, a person really has to work a long time on to remove. That's one of the strongest ones, the ego. And it has many expressions. He wants events to go a certain way, so he curses the judge. But there's also a displacement over there that you should realize. He's being angry with the person, but God really made the system. So it's not pointing out to you that if you would look and see that it's God's wisdom that demands this, you couldn't possibly have this type of a gripe. And if you look and see how it benefits society, certainly you can't have a gripe. You see how it really benefits. You wouldn't be so angry if the judge told the other guy to give you the $1 million, would you? Oh, there all of a sudden you're so happy, you're ecstatic about the justice system. The judge system is fantastic, the courts of Jewish people, wow, this is great, I just won $1 million. Well, that person who just lost $1 million is not saying that, unless he's perfected. Okay. And even the last case, it says in verse 30, it says, you sanctify people, you shall be to me. And how is that expressed? If you find a dead animal in the field, you don't eat it, but you give it to your dog. This one we're going to have fun with. What is going on with this verse? That was Cal laughing, right? Yes, Cal enjoys that. Me too. This is something now, you know, you see a little theme, and now we feel like we've made a little headway over here, and boom, we now have a verse that just seems to be holy people is talking about. It didn't talk about holy people before. And now it's talking about, you find a dead animal in the field, don't eat it, but give it to your dog. I mean, and this is somehow tied in with the first two ideas. All right, so let's take a pause and see if there's think about it. Now that we've made some headway, hopefully we are on the right track. Let's see if we can see how this last puzzle piece fits in.
So there seems to be an underlying theme of getting clear about the concept of ownership. As you say, the natural thing is, gee, what's mine is mine. Some people say what's yours is negotiable. But maybe that carries over to this last one, because you would think if I walk along and I find something, it ought to be mine. And yet...
Well, it is yours. You can keep it. You just can't eat it.
Yeah, but if it's mine, I have rights to do what I want with it. And here those rights are being restricted. And so I don't have as much right, if you will, to certain things as I thought I did. I don't have rights to my first fruits. I don't necessarily have rights to my own children. I don't even necessarily have the right to the outcome I want when I walk in the court.
Right.
I'm subjected to a system that's greater than me.
Well, again, doesn't that apply to every command? I want you to tell me something that's unique about this specific verse. Then we know that we're understanding this verse.
These particular verses deal directly or indirectly with possessions.
Well, so does the law of charity. So does the law of bringing sacrifices on the holidays. Here, again, keep in mind, what are the unique statements in these verses? You should not curse. You shouldn't delay. And then you're going to have to tell me what in verse 30, what's the unique. We have to really extract what's new here that wasn't mentioned in other places. Then we'll understand, or we'll be on a better track to understand what God's intent, God's lesson is in this unique, these unique verses.
Well, do not curse and do not delay has to do with perhaps my emotional inclination to react to a situation. And this one seems like it's do not eat, which is my instinctive...
Good. Good. I would agree with you. Here it's saying don't eat.
Can I ask a question? Have we moved on to this flesh of the animal that was thrown in the field?
Yeah, but ask a question. Go ahead.
Well, I know this is treif. Maybe that, you know, the animal is treif, and you're not supposed to eat it. But I guess what I'm curious about is if you're out in the field and you know the animal, let's say it's a kosher animal, and you find the animal in the field. I guess my question is, yes, it's treif. You know, it can't be offered as a sacrifice. But I guess my question is, why can't you eat it? I mean, you see what I'm saying? I mean, it's...
Because slaughter is the only way a Jew's allowed to eat meat. It's only, you know, just applying to a Jew. That we have to only eat meat that was slaughtered. And this animal was killed by another animal.
Okay, it has to be kosher.
Yeah. So, but you can pick up this animal. It's yours to keep. It's a wild animal. There's no dog collar on it, you know. But it says also, keep in mind that you should give it to your dog. Don't eat it, but give it to your dog to eat. Which is an interesting conclusion. I mean, what's the lesson?
Well, it has value. It has value. It just doesn't have value to me. I mean,
yeah,
I'm Jewish. It doesn't have value to me, but it has value to the dog.
Yeah.
Well, the dogs are being rewarded for following God.
Yeah, that's what I think Rashi says.
Yeah, commandment.
They didn't wet their tongues when the Jews left Egypt. That's an interesting statement itself. Where do you have the concept of an animal getting reward? But maybe we'll take that up after we address this, because that is a very startling statement. Actually, I'll read you the Rashi that you're quoting. It says here, are you quoting Rashi or are you quoting somebody else? Is this your own idea?
I've read it in the commentaries that come with our...
Oh, okay, good. So, they're quoting Rashi, but I'm sure Rashi got this. He says that, what does it mean that to the dogs you should give it? It comes to teach you that the dogs are honored, shekelav nichvad mimeno, that the dogs are more honored than you, right? And to teach you that God does not hold back the reward of any creature. Because it says in Exodus 11 that when the Jews left, that the dogs did not bark at the Jews. So therefore God says, give them their reward. Give them this meat. This reward, it's not even the same dog. You're talking about 3,000 years ago. The dog is dead by now. And I'm going to give my dog meat, and that's a reward to the dogs that didn't bark in Egypt? That compounds the question.
Doesn't it say that God rewards those thousands of generations down?
Well, that's the individual.
But Rabbi, also it forces you to recall the Exodus from Egypt, correct? I mean, it's, in other words, it's not just a passive action. A person who does that would do it with, you know, fully cognizant of the fact that I'm doing this as a reminder of what happened.
Okay, good.
And for the Jewish people. so it brings him into a reality of what actually happened. It reinforces it in his own mind.
Right. That's a good. It's a good answer. That by doing this, it's another means for our own perfection. It has to be. It's not for the dog. The only problem is, what's the statement that God doesn't hold back the reward of every creature? Sounds like, I mean, God evidently, I mean, the dogs didn't bark. Why didn't they bark? They should have barked, right? So you're telling me that the dog has free will? No. Sorry. They do not have free will. Evidently, the dogs didn't bark. For what reason? How did the dogs not bark? Because God made a miracle. That's how. And then we have to ask, well, why was it necessary for God to tell the dogs not to bark as the Jews left? Because it was necessary then for the Jews not to have this feeling of going out like animals are barking at them. But they were completely dignified going out, and that was why God told Moses to tell the people to ask the Egyptians for gold and silver, clothing, and they did, and they gave it to the Jews, and the Jews went out very proud. Now the oppressors were serving them, and no dog was barking. They weren't disheveled physically, and they were not oppressed psychologically by the bark and of the hounds that they had in Egypt. They went out in a very peaceful state of mind. So that evidently that was necessary in terms of the state of the Jews as they left, that there should not be any type of a harassed type of a feeling. It is an interesting thing, but the statement that God does not hold back the reward of every creature, and therefore if you find meat that you can't eat, give it to your dog. So I like your idea, you were saying, that it makes us call back to that event, and then that, and in turn, that causes us to recognize another aspect of God's kindness that He bestowed on those Jews. He didn't let them feel harassed by barking. It was peaceful going out psychologically. But why call it reward? The dog doesn't have free will, right? That's like the last question. Why call it reward? Just say that, give it to the dog. That would satisfy that. That would be in line with your answer. We give it to the dog, not because of reward. We give it to him because we recognize what God did. So it's a good way for us to recall the Exodus, another aspect of the God was kind to us when we left. But the fact that you throw in the statement that you're giving a reward to the dog, what's that reward? He doesn't have free will. It's not even the same dog. All right, good question.
Yep. Is there any question about the word reward that's being used by Rashi?
I don't know. I mean, it's reward is reward. That's what it means. It says openly, God does not hold back reward from any creature. Therefore, He said, give this meat to the dog. That sounds so, it doesn't sound metaphoric in terms of, God wants this dog to have it. It is a reward of sorts. I mean, that's why they're using the word reward. There's got to be some concept of reward that's applicable here. Otherwise, you would not have the rabbis formulating that statement. Okay, why don't we hold on to that? We'll come back to that in a minute. Let's just finish up our verses. So again, we're now at the last verse where if you find meat in the field and it was killed anyway besides slaughter, you can't eat it, and you must give it to your dog. And it also says you're to be a sanctified people. It also says you're supposed to be a sanctified people as well. So you have three things. You're a sanctified people is number one. Don't eat meat that's not slaughtered. And third, give it to your dog. Okay, somebody had a question?
Well, Rabbi, I guess I'm still kind of hung up on this good deed. No good deed goes unrewarded. I'm thinking more of it in terms of the good deed that's being rewarded is really not for the dog, but for the people who are actually showing compassion to the dog.
That's not what it says. God saying he doesn't hold back reward from any creature, meaning the dog. That's why you're giving the meat to the dog. We'll take it up in a minute. Well, let's come back to this. I'm going to leave off our mindset from the verses. Then we'll come and take up the statement from Rashi. Right, if you want to just jot it down so you don't forget it. Who's that, Brad?
No, it's Bill.
Oh, Bill. Okay, yeah, just jot it down just to make sure that we do take it up. But I just want to finish up the verses, then we'll go to the... Because it's more of a peripheral point. So I'd like to just focus on the main topic, try to wrap that up so we have that clear, and then we'll go on, all right?
Okay,
so now we're trying to understand... We understand that cursing the judge as the case goes against you is a denial of accepting the objective system in terms of events that transpire. And then we also have the expression of intolerance when I know I've got to give something to the priests, but I delay. So that's like a passive type of an aggression. Right, it's the same thing with with the judge when you curse him as you're leaving under your breath. You are intolerant. You can't change yourself to be in line with an objective system. God created you, and God gave you a system, and now you say, "No, I want to keep this for myself. I want it. It's mine." That subjective, that egotistical emotion, but now it's attached to wealth, not to events. So we've seen that we need to have a secondary expression. That's why it's here together in this very area. Okay, so we see a theme in developing, that the subjective world is what we have to abandon. And even in the slightest way, even if we just delay giving it, I'm giving the thing, I'm giving the animal to the priest, I just waited an extra day. No, even that is something which you must be exact, like you were saying the word before, Doug, scrupulous. There's a tendency in man not to be scrupulous. But that's coming from that emotion of greed, of I want things to go the way I want them. I want more wealth. I don't want my day ruined by the fact that I've got to comply with the judge. I have certain events, the way I see the day going, and now I've got to stop and reorganize my way. But you see, it opens us up to that mindset. We all identify with that. It's a truth. We have a day, we have a plan, the certain things we want to do, and how many times have our day has been messed up because certain events came up that we had to do, and we did it begrudgingly. So it's telling us here, be aware of that, and don't do it begrudgingly. Don't give in to that emotion, how slight it might be of delaying giving what you're supposed to give, or cursing the judge. And of course, philosophically, this applies to the case we talked about before. Your next-door neighbor's out of town, and his wife's car broke down, and the kid has to go to soccer practice right lunch break when you wanted to shoot a couple of holes of golf. So now nobody else is around. You should really forfeit golf for today, and you're helping out somebody. And it shouldn't be something that you feel bad about. I mean, if you do have that initial response, that's just human. There's no way to control at times the initial response that we have, but catch yourself. Think about the good that can be done here, and think about the sensitivity of a 7-year-old kid who wants to go to that soccer game. Think about his emotions. Think about how you can help out somebody. And we put it in the right framework, then we can be it's easier to say, you know what, the golf thing was not so important, and this is going to be very good. You're going to help out and think about the good feelings that you're going to create in your community. So there's so much. The right mindset is really going to turn a person around 180, and he'll think about it, he'll approach it properly. But since there are,
you're saying, Rabbi, that the events that take place on a normal day-to-day basis should offer an opportunity as a teaching lesson. You know, they should teach us something about ourselves and our reactions.
Yeah, certainly.
What can we learn from them? How can we be better as a result of them? You know, if you go to work and you expect a paycheck every 1st and 15th, and then one day the paycheck comes in, it's delayed by a day. I mean, generally, what's our attitude? I mean, our attitude generally is to begin to think all kinds of demeaning things about our employer. He cheated me. He didn't do this. We don't normally think of it in terms of, well, maybe there was a problem with the bank. They couldn't transfer the money. They couldn't. You know, our first reaction is to be very negative about our employer and what he may have done to me and what injustice he may have caused simply because I didn't get my paycheck in exactly the time I was supposed to get it.
Right. There was actually a Talmudic portion that addresses this specifically, where somebody was working for another guy, and I don't remember the case clearly. I'm sorry, but in general, he was supposed to give him money and pay him for a job. He didn't have it, and then this happened, and the employer again had an excuse, and the third time it happened, he had an excuse again. All three times, the employee accepted the explanation of the employer. Finally, the employer came back to the employee with all the money, everything, and he paid him. But the employer was very, very puzzled why his employee was so calm and accepted every single one of his excuses. So he says to him, "What did you think when I told you that I didn't have the money, or this happened, or the animal came and ate this?" He says, "I accepted. That's, you know, what happened." And he says, the employer says again to him, "Well, what did you think when I told you this happened and that happened and these excuses?" So the employee said, "I accepted that that was a possibility." So it ended up that the employer says, you know, that is exactly what happened. The employer was not lying. So that Talmudic portion is showing you how a person, you know, you should take a person on his word. If you're working with somebody and he's honest, and, you know, we should only work for honest people, of course. But if, you know, the person's got some sort of a, you know, plausible explanation, especially in a case where it's only one day delay in a paycheck, that's nothing to really get, you know, blown out of shape. If you needed money that day, you could always borrow from somebody, you know. But you're right. You should use these opportunities. And that's exactly what this last verse is telling you, that when you're out in the field and you find an animal, wow, I didn't have to hunt nothing. Here's this animal, this beautiful deer. One problem is I can't enjoy it. I just can't eat it. It's not shechted, it's not slaughtered, and therefore I can't eat it. So the normal emotions is to right away, you know, want to have that expression of them. And here's now, where, like you were saying before, Doug, the nuance here, the difference in this third case, it's here where the emotions, the instinctual drives, so here also, and that's what it means, Kodesh. Whenever the instinctual drives are involved and we separate ourselves from the instincts, that is when the term Kodesh is used. That's why only in this third case does it say you should be a holy people, because only in this expression are now you doing something where you're governing your most basic of all instincts. And like Freud says, the most basic instincts are the sexual and the appetitive drive. So in those areas, actually, Maimonides grouped those laws together in a book called the Book of Holiness, the Book of Sanctity. And in that book, he includes all the laws on sexual laws and all laws on foods, what you can eat, when you can eat. Why? Because real sanctity is when a person is going, he's addressing the most primary instinctual drives. Now here, this fellow was in the field and he found an animal, and wouldn't it be great now just to cook off this animal and eat? But he can't do it. He's controlling, I can't eat this now. But he also doesn't just go to the opposite extreme, because you do have a certain concept called reaction formation. That is when you turn off your emotions completely. For example, this would be a case where, like, if a person is told, you know, you shouldn't, let's just say a person feels guilty about somebody that did something wrong. Somebody did something wrong to me and I don't like them. And I feel guilty. You know, the Torah says I shouldn't have this hatred in my heart. So what do? I go to the opposite extreme and I just become his best friend and everything. That's wrong, because now that's a denial of what you really have. In the case where somebody wronged me, you don't go to an opposite extreme to deny this and try to be like, you know, that's what a monk does. That's what an ascetic does. So we are not like that. We accept reality. The system of Torah is where you're accepting reality. So what's the reality in this case? The guy did something wrong to me. I can't hate him. So what I should do, the Torah tells me. You have to rebuke your fellow man and tell him what you did wrong to me. And don't keep it buried in your heart. Here also, it's true, you can't have the animal, but that doesn't mean there's any taboo. I was discussing this yesterday with Rabbi Mann. He brought in that fact. Don't attach any taboo to this thing. There's nothing wrong with the animal. You just can't eat it. That is the only thing that you cannot do, the act of eating. In every other way, the animal's yours. Find its keepers. So give it to your dog, meaning look at it in a way where it's a not. Don't add on emotions. Don't go to the opposite extreme, and don't, I mean, to say that there's many ways that we can distort things. We want events to go a certain way, so, you know, we really want it to go the way we want it, you know, so it didn't go the way, so I curse the judge. or I don't want to give this animal what a beautiful ox this is. You know, I don't want to give it, so I delay it just so I can hold on to it one more day and express my ownership a little bit more, enjoy the fact that it's mine. Or if I delay giving my son and redeeming him, it's my son. Who's the Torah to tell me I'm going to give my son? But that's in terms of the reluctance because you want it to go your way. There's also another emotion, and that is when you have the case here where you feel something is, you don't want to give in. Like in this case here, you see the Torah is addressing that it doesn't say, you know, don't eat the animal and don't lick it, because maybe a person will say, well, I can't eat it. Well, maybe I'll have a little taste of it. I won't cook it. You know, I'll do something. See, that would be an example of where you're still trying to give in to your own predisposition. That's one type of issue that the Torah addresses with the first two cases. Don't try to hold on to your own predisposed emotions. Okay, that's one type of an issue. That's another type of an issue, or a response, I should say, is when a person will see something and he'll think he'll be overly righteous. Oh, this animal is not slaughtered. I can't have it. That's it. I'm going to destroy it, throw it out. It's no good. Nobody can have it, not even my dog. See, that's the opposite type of response. You see, there's two ways a person can respond to restriction. One type of restriction in terms of when I want things to go a certain way, that's what these cases all are about. Subjective phenomena. So I can either fight to keep it the way I want it, so I'll curse the judge, or I'll hold on to the animal one longer day, or I can do the opposite maneuver, and I'll be like overly righteous, and I'll say, oh, this animal is it's not kosher, therefore nothing about it. That's what people say, you know, like a lot of people have this concept. They think that a dog is like, I don't know where it comes from, but they're amazed that people have pets. Like a person that's following the Torah, having a pet is some sort of a problem. And why? They say that because the dog is not kosher. Oh, since it's not kosher, you shouldn't have the dog. Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, there's no law that, you know, if you were able to tame, you know, a horse is not kosher. You never see there's any problem in the past with using horses for work and people owning them and traveling with them. I mean, this is something, it's a creature, you know, that God created for our man's benefit. So the two lessons here is not to try to hold on to the subjective, whether it's in terms of events. I want the events to go my way in court, or I want my money, and now I've got to give this animal, I'm giving away my money. That's one type of expression with a person that has now got to be very scrupulous about even delays in this era. He's giving the animal to the priest, and he's accepting what the judge said to him. But he's doing it in a way which is begrudging. That is something which the Torah is now is fine, the fine point over here. Don't do these things in a way where now there's a certain amount of retention of your own emotional predisposition. No, do it completely as God said. This is the best thing for you. Okay, so that's the, it's a tendency. It's an expression of reluctance and frustration that God is trying to focus in over here. That's what I believe this case is talking about. And then there's also the opposite, where you just go overboard. You know, something is no good, so therefore the whole thing is no good. I can't eat the animal, so it's completely null and void. I can't even give it to my animal. No, that's ridiculous. It has value. It has worth. You could save yourself on going to the store and getting dog food for a month. Take the animal, refrigerate it, and use it slowly for your pet. Whatever the need is. And I mean, you see this emotion in the Torah, where God says, don't add on to the Torah and don't subtract. God says this because he knows that there is the over-religious emotion in people. God says, do this. Oh, I'm going to do even more than what God said. So that's wrong. Don't add and don't subtract. I mean, don't think that you can now be more righteous than God. And here the expression is where you're giving it your, it's a taboo. You're creating a taboo, like Rabbi Mann had mentioned. Okay, let me pause here and see if any questions or comments.
Rabbi, would you be willing to answer, I believe it's a halakhic question for me regarding this?
If I can.
Okay, I know it says, you know, when it says that the person here, he is delaying his offering, but the assumption is that even though he's delaying the offering, at some point he's going to bring the offering, okay, which, you know, it's a positive mitzvah, correct?
Right.
Bring the offering?
Yes.
So, in a sense, if he is, I guess what I'm asking for is, where is the sin in this in relationship to bringing a sacrifice, and what category would this fall under regarding offerings? In other words, if a person, you know, is it a sin offering, and not, you know, a guilt offering? I mean, has he violated a negative commandment here by doing what he's doing, so he has to bring this offering to atone for it?
Well, here it's talking about the firstborn. I don't think it's a problem with the sacrifice per se. It's an emotional problem that he has to address. I think the animal itself is still perfectly intact. The sacrifice will be perfectly intact.
Okay.
Where, for example, a person's got to do circumcision, like somebody was talking about earlier. So even though you didn't do it on the eighth day, you still have to do it. So there was a flaw in the fact that you delayed doing it to your son on the eighth day, but you could still do it later. And the circumcision is just as good. So it's not a flaw.
So he hasn't violated a commandment in that sense, right?
Well, he's violated this command of delay. He violated God's command not to delay.
Okay.
Okay,
yeah, I was just curious about that.
Yeah, okay. So you see that what God is saying in the conclusionary statement that you should be a sanctified people, meaning that you really have to, when it comes down to the base emotions, and these are all about emotions, where you have to handle the emotions properly and identify the issue and, you know, view yourself objectively and then, you know, be observing yourself on a daily basis and seeing where these little type of delays and reluctances are coming out, and understand that these are expressions of a corruption. Okay, so it's a more of a very psychological part of the Torah. It's giving you a nice insight into things we know are true. It really is, you know, concretizing it and showing, you know, real life examples of how this takes place. So you see, the laws are not just to do this, don't do that, in terms of, you know, brute activity or prayers, but you have very delicate things that are being addressed. We see with the target of the people, the Jews, now being this sanctified people. Right? This degree is not demanded from everybody, although everybody benefits equally by following it. But it's trying to target what the optimum way of life is. That's really what the Torah is doing, is trying to give man the optimum path in life, in all areas. Okay. All right, so now we come to the dog and the reward that we were talking about before. So giving it to the dog is now, God says, I mean, Rashi is quoting, it says that God doesn't hold back reward from any creature. So if you find this non-slaughtered carcass, then give it to your dog as a reward. So how is it a reward? That's the question. I mean, again, keep in mind, dogs don't have free will. How do you even have this concept of reward? When reward only makes sense when the being has free will to do something.
You know, for me, Rabbi, just as a point, you know, I can't remember. I know if it's in Proverbs or if it's in Tehillim Psalms, where it says that the rain falls upon the just and the unjust. So that even though the rain may fall on the just, you know, and be a blessing from Hashem, even the unjust benefit from it. And so, in a sense, you know, that it seems like the dog is getting the benefit of somebody acting compassionately on his behalf, because he's incapable of it himself, because he's a dog. I don't know if that makes any sense or not.
Well, how is it a reward, though?
He has no free...
The analogy is no good, yeah. Because you're equating just and unjust people. That means there's some there's some response that has to go to them because they did something either just or unjust by the rain. But the dog is completely out of the category of just or unjust.
Thanks.
Rabbi, could you read the quote from Rashi about the reward one more time, please?
Certainly. He says, so what do we learn from the fact that it says in the verse, to your dog should you cast this carcass? It comes to teach you that the dog is more honored than you. I'm not sure what that means, honored than you, honored than it. But the main point he's saying is this, to teach you that God does not hold back rewards from any creation, because it states that the dogs did not bark at the Jews, so therefore when the Jews left Egypt, so therefore God says, give it its reward.
Well, it seems to me that if we define a reward as something you only get from a free will decision, and if we have established that animals do not have free will, then we would have to interpret the reward as something applicable to man in this, not the dog.
You're not giving anything to the man here. It says openly, you're giving it its reward. Tenu lo scharo, give it, the dog, its reward.
So you're walking through the woods and it's the dog that found the carcass.
No, you found it. Your dog's at home sleeping, having a lemonade on the hammock. In his Bermuda shorts. Think about it for a moment. I want to do the same. It's not an easy question. I didn't come prepared. This is a question that somebody asked. Either Bill or Brad, I forget who asked the question, but it's intriguing. So I want to give me a minute or two. I just want to think about this. Yes.
Have I?
Yeah.
Does it have anything, how did God do the miracle with the dogs? In other words, does this have anything to do with, dogs respond to stimuli. So they get rewarded because they respond to a command that we want them to do. So they're not using their free will, but they just respond to the stimuli. Does that have anything, does that tie in at all, or...
I don't know how God did the miracle of causing every single dog to not bark. All I know is that God did it. It can't be, anything but a miracle.
Rabbi, in Ashrei, there is a statement, you give them their food in its proper time. So could it be that the reward here is not the reward that we think of with regard to a human, but is God giving the dog its food, its need for sustenance, through this particular animal?
He's giving what? Say it again.
I'm thinking of the verse in Ashrei that says, you give them their food in its proper time. You open your hand and satisfy the desire of every living thing.
Right.
So is it that when it speaks of reward here, it's not reward in the sense of you made a free will decision, but it's reward in the sense of God giving you, meaning giving the dog, the food and sustenance that it needs at that particular time.
So then you don't need to have this whole fact that the dog didn't bark. Even without the dog, even if the dog was barking like crazy, it should be applicable that God gives food to every animal and he needs it.
But every creature that does not have free will, I may be reaching way out in left field, but every creature is supposed to follow God's will, and the only one that has free will is man. So the dogs, in being commanded by God not to bark, in fact fulfilled that requirement, and therefore, I guess if you say, met the requirement of fulfilling God's word, which is, I would say, a requirement to be able to continue to exist.
I don't understand.
In other words, if they had gone and barked, if they could have, then they would have been a creature that could defy Hashem's will, and therefore, I think, would probably cease to exist.
But they couldn't. That's not a possibility. It's not a possibility. God made the miracle that they shouldn't bark. That's it. They can't bark. God made water moist. There's no way water could not be moist.
Well, that's the point, Rob. I mean, the dog, as you said, has no free will. So its basic instinct, the instinct of the dog would have been to bark. That would have been his natural reaction. But like you said, it was a miracle that the dog did not bark. So in essence, Hashem had to intervene in the laws of nature to make sure those dogs didn't bark. The question is, why is there a reward for that?
Right. There's no free will. What's this concept?
So I guess my question, I'm reading it in the Chumash, in the commentary, it says it's permitted to dispose of the meat in other ways as well, but the Torah teaches us to show gratitude just as God does not let any good deed go unrewarded. Does that statement, is it in relationship to what happened with the dogs here, or is the commentator...
Yeah, it's a relationship to the dogs, exactly. It's in relationship, that's what Rashi says.
Okay.
Give me 1 minute, Doug.
Wasn't there a case where Moses, because he was in the Nile as a child, later in his life there was, when he did the miracle of the blood, I want to say that he poured the blood out on dry land. There was something there about not, if you will, disrespecting the water because that was what he was saved out of.
He's talking about that he didn't do the first two, or the first three actually. He didn't smite the water or smite the dust because the water saved him and when he was in the basket, and the earth saved him when he buried the Egyptian after killing him because the Egyptian was beating up on another Jew. So he had to show recognition that the in terms of these creations that they have a benefit. So there was a concept of him not doing those plagues because it would have been ignoring the good that these parts of creation had, but not as a reward to those parts of creation. It was just
right, but I would say there is an analogy there because, I mean, the water's not alive either. It didn't really do anything for him. It was all from Hashem's will, and yet there was a certain level of...
It doesn't say reward there, though. It doesn't say that God was rewarding the dust and rewarding the Nile. That's completely...
I understand, but there was a certain level of respect shown, even though those are inanimate objects.
Good, and I agree with you. Over here also, we are now recognizing God's greatness to us by making the miracle and not making us be frightened by dogs as we're leaving, and he shut all their mouths, so we give the meat to the dog today in recognition of that kindness that God did. But I'm not ignoring that. I admit that is a truth. The question is, what is the concept, in the words of the rabbis, that God does not hold back the reward of every creature, and said, give this meat to the dog, to give him his reward. It's twice. It's very clear. Give me 1 minute. I just want to think about this for a minute.
Okay.
Give me 1 minute. You see what I'm distinguishing, though, right?
I do.
Okay. All right. Approach, unless somebody there wants to say something first.
It's Doug. I have one further thought, and that is, I think the key turns on if you define reward only as something given for an act of free will. If reward can be defined in other ways, then I think there are possibilities.
All right, go ahead. I would agree with that approach.
Well, then I would probably hearken it to, you know, the dogs are given an award of food, you know, because they fulfilled the purpose of their creator. Granted, the creator can do whatever the creator wants. But if you hinge it on it has to be an act of free will, then I think you're caught because...
Yeah, I agree. It's no free will.
Dogs don't have free will.
But why would you have to continue rewarding them, you know, 3,000 years later?
Well, like Rosora is writing on screen now, it's a way of remembering the miracle and showing thanks to God. So, again, it's not the reward for anything the specific dog did, but it's a good thing for us
It adds to our appreciation for another aspect of the Exodus.
And I would say it's not unlike the situation of Moses not doing the miracles against the water.
Right, in that respect, right.
Yeah.
Right, that we're...
putting the water, but he's acknowledging it respectfully.
Right, exactly. It's an acknowledgement of a good that God did, and therefore I'm doing an action or an inaction in order to uphold that truth. I'm just wondering if you could say that when it says reward, it means that God's system of Torah, of the commands that he gives to man, and the animals, I mean, even just this event, so when since God runs the system, he makes sure that everything works properly. So the dogs are completely under his control for the sake of not frightening the Jews as they're leaving. And in the system itself of the Torah, God makes sure that everything is reciprocal, that it's a good reciprocal system, and it's self-sufficient, so to speak. So he created the dog with this ability and inabilities, and he also creates a system where everything is taken care of. So things that are taken care of, in as much as they are functioning in God's will. So to say that it gets reward, it means to imply that it functioned in line with God's will. Everything responds to what God does. He demands that a certain miracle take place, and that's it. There's nothing which stands in the way of God's control. So that's the first thing we learn by saying, now give the meat to the dog as a reward, meaning that it is completely, everything is completely under God's control. And to give something back to it is to underscore that truth. So it's not a reward for the free will, of course. You're saying reward because you're saying that something functioned in line with God's will. So that's why you get a reward in general. You do the will, or you did the will of something else. So therefore, the thing that you did the will of now reciprocates and condones that, yes, you did exactly what you were told to do. That doesn't mean that you had free will. I'm just trying to show you how you can explain, like you were saying, Doug, there's a different way to explain the word reward. Reward simply is a way to reciprocate that something complied with a will. Could be a man is giving a reward to his kid, or a CEO is giving her an award to his top employee of the month, or God is giving a reward to the dog. In all cases, there is a recognition that the person, the animal, the being, the object, worked properly. So you're saying that this thing worked properly at this point. So you're giving the meat to demonstrate that God's will came true, that God did this for us. But the concept of reward is that it's underlying the fact that it responded properly. And I'm just wondering why you have to do it here. You have another case which may pose a problem. Not on this answer, but it may just introduce another question. Because it says when God created the trees of fruits, he said, let there be trees of fruit bearing fruit. And when they finally came into existence, it wasn't a tree of fruit, meaning God initially said, let the tree be edible as well as the fruit being edible. But when it came into being, the tree is not edible, only the fruit is edible. So it says that later on, that when man was smitten, when man was punished, the tree was also punished. So here you have the same question again. You have an inanimate or something that has no free will. A tree has no free will. I'm just going to tell you the exact verse, so you can take a look now. This is in Genesis 8. I think it's 1:12. Let me see here. That's where the verse is. Let's see, is that right? Okay, 112. I think that was it. One second. It says it's not serious. The earth brought forth out. We shall know the name. Right. It's free. It's on it. Yeah, it's Rashi on 111. Genesis 111. So God said in 111, he says, God says, let the earth bring forth herbs, the field, grasses, that Mazria Zera, that give forth of their seed, and also trees of fruit that make fruit. Right? Genesis 1:11, trees of fruit that make fruit. So that means not only is it going to make fruit, but the tree itself is edible. Okay? Okay. Now you look at Rashi on 1:11 in Genesis. It says that the tree should have the same flavor as the fruit. But it didn't do that. But what happened? It says in the next verse that the earth brought forth trees bearing fruit, not a tree of fruit bearing fruit. So he says that the tree didn't fulfill God's will. Therefore, when Adam was cursed on his sin, the tree was also remembered with Adam and was also cursed. So it was a punishment to the tree. Okay, so now we have two cases where you don't have will, but you seem to have reward or punishment. But I think over here, what the lesson over here by the tree is just trying to show you that there is an optimum that God would want to have in the physical world, but by definition, the physical world is limited. And that really is a good. Yeah, the more food, the better for man. But it still says it was punished. That means that God wanted the optimum was that even the tree could be edible. But it didn't. I mean, to say physical nature could not tolerate that, maybe because that would destroy all the ability for reproduction. If people ate the fruits on the tree, then there's nothing to give you fruits next year. So it's best that I mean, to say the optimum would be where the majority of creation satisfied man's needs in terms of his own physical life, food. So what's better, if he only has a fruit from the tree to eat, or if he can even eat all the branches in the tree trunk as well? Well, the latter would definitely be better. There'd be more food to go around. But that wasn't so. But it still says it was cursed. When man, so we have to think about what that means, that when man was cursed in his sin, so the tree was also remembered. That means it's some relationship. Because, and again, man sinned with the tree, you keep in mind. So there's a relationship. It's not just, you know, throwing curses together. It was convenient today for God to take care of all the curses. Since I'm cursing man, I'll curse the tree now, which deserves to be cursed also, just because it's easier, an economy of punishment. No, it means that there's a relationship. Man abused the fruit. He went and took more than what he wanted. So now I guess God addressed the tree. I mean, he's not cursing the tree because the tree did anything wrong. He's cursing the tree now because man's sin of eating of more than what he was told to eat, now he was indulging more in the physical than he should have. Right? God said you could have everything but this one tree. Man didn't listen. So therefore, when he curses man and he sends him out of the garden and he makes him work and he gives him activities to preoccupy himself, so his energies are not just free-floating and going into sin, so now he also does, he makes a change in the tree as well. In order that there's a safeguard that man won't do this again. So that's what it means that God curses the tree as well. It's for man's benefit, because that's where man overextended himself. He went too far. It's like a kid who you say, here's 10 chocolate bars, and I'm putting them in the fridge. You could have one each day for the next 10 days. So he goes today and he takes two instead of one. So the punishment is that you take not just
tomorrow's out, but now you take out six more. So now for the next 6 days, he's not going to have any chocolate bars. Why? Because that will now help control him. If you just, he doesn't get tomorrow, so that may not be a stiff enough of a correction. So in order to correct where the emotion's going, emotions go in a certain direction. Let's say a person, for example, is really miserly with his money. So Maimonides says, anytime you have an emotion to one extreme, the way you get yourself perfected is you go to the opposite extreme. And then eventually you'll balance out in the middle. So if you're so miserly, you never give a cent to charity, so then you should be very overabundant in giving until you neutralize and you fall in the middle. This way, you're not too much giving, you're not too much of a miser. And like Rabbi Chait explained, the reason why you want to be in the middle is now you're equidistant from the strong magnetic pull of both poles of that spectrum, that emotional spectrum of greed and charitable giving. You want to be like any emotion. You want to be right in the middle, because if you're too much giving, your emotions have got you. If you're too miserly, again, your emotions got you, and your energies can't be free to go into wisdom, which is the objective always. So by going from one extreme to the other, you tend to neutralize where you started out, and then you balance out in the middle, and now you're not being pulled by either extreme of the emotion, so now your energies are free to be involved in wisdom. So that's why God would have to then punish the tree too, because since man indulged in the tree that he should have had, so now God will even limit it more. So man will have more of a protective device not to go into that indulgent anymore. All right, make sense? Okay, so that's good for the tree. That makes sense. So we understand how punishment could apply to something which is inanimate, because really it's for man. Now, let's go back to the dog case. So you're saying that it's a reward. So again, like you said, that we are recognizing the good that God did as we leave. I'm just wondering if there's any connection between this specific case of finding a carcass in the field. And this is when we have to now give it to the dog. I mean, I can think of other cases where you may, you know, have some meat, whatever, and like, for example, if you shecht an animal, you slaughter an animal, you didn't do it right, so why doesn't it say over there, give it to the dog? No, it says give it to the dog in the case where you found it in the field. I'm wondering if there's some connection. This is now the right time to address those dogs in Egypt. All right, 3,318 years later, here we are, and I'm still giving meat that I find in the street to my dog because of that event in Egypt when they didn't bark. Let's see.
It's possible that that's because it would be very easy to walk by it and just leave it. A flesh torn from an animal.
The harder thing is probably to forfeit that great gain of you get a carcass right there. You know, just killed. If it's rotting meat, we don't care about it. It's probably a fresh kill. And wow, you know, a lot of energy a person's got to spend on getting an animal like this. And now it's so. What was the state of the Jews? The Ibn Ezra said that when they were going out, God didn't allow them to bark, so they shouldn't frighten the Jews. They shouldn't have frightened them. Let's take a look at the verse itself. Exodus, where was it? Do you have the quote there?
11:7, I think.
11:7. Right. Right, so Ibn Ezra says, right, to frighten them. Just one word. He says, God did not allow the dogs to bark to frighten the Jews. Frighten the Jews. What does it say in that whole verse? It says, look, it is right after. Let's look 5. This is the death of the firstborn in 11:5. And there died all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Paro that sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the maidservant that was behind the grinding wheel, and all firstborn animals. And there was a great cry in all the land of Egypt that beforehand there never was, and afterwards there never will be a cry like that. But all the Jews, a dog didn't even bark. From man to animal. in order that they should know that God distinguishes between Egypt and Israel. So this is, I think, where Moses is telling this to Pharaoh. No, God is telling this to Moses. Right. 11:4 says, so does God say at the midnight. So Moses is repeating over what will happen. Okay. Now let's see when it actually takes place. This is the announcement of the death of the firstborn. Now, and it goes into the first of the month. And where does it pick up again? Right, so now let's jump to 12:29. So it was the middle of the night, and God smote all the firstborn of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh that sat on his throne, to the firstborn of the servant that was in the prison, and all animals. And God and Pharaoh got up at night, him and all of his servants, and all of Egypt. And it was a great cry in Egypt, because there was not any house that didn't have a dead person in it. And they called to Moses and to Aaron at night, in the middle of the night, said, get up and get out, you and all of the B'nai Israel, right, and go serve your God like you spoke. And also your sheep and your cattle take with you, like you spoke, and bless me as well. And Egypt was very much urgent on the Jews to send them out, because they said, we're all going to die. They didn't think that it was just going to be the firstborns. So the people picked up their loaf before it got leavened from their kneading troughs, and they rolled them up into their garments, and they put them on the shoulders. All right, and the Jews did as Moses said, and they asked the Egyptians for vessels of silver and gold and clothing. And God gave grace in the eyes of the people, and they despoiled Egypt. Okay. Okay, it doesn't say. So it doesn't say when it actually took place. It doesn't say what the dogs did, but it was an announcement of Moses that it was going to happen. And certainly it did happen, but you didn't have to record every event. And then it goes into the fact that they left. Right. Let me just see just to make sure. So it doesn't say when it took place. At the time of the event, it doesn't say. So what is the concept? It shouldn't frighten them. So again, I'm just thinking on the surface that what we're doing is by giving, that being a command in the Torah, that means the Torah system is self-sufficient, that what God does is everything works properly. Then he makes a command, the animal listens, and not because of free will, and then we recognize that by giving it. And it's called reward only because it's something which follow God's will. God's will. So that makes sense, right? I mean, that basically the answer sounds like it makes sense to me. What about you?
Sense to me.
Right? Makes sense. The only question, so that explains why the term reward is here. Reward is good because it's something which complied. So you recognize that it complied with God's will. Not that it has free will, it just did what it was supposed to do. All right. The only other question is why it's in connection when you find a carcass. Why is that the right time to now reflect on this thing that happened in Egypt? Because when we're leaving, we're frightened.
Well, Rabbi, could it harken back to the earlier part of the verse where it says, "People of holiness shall you be to me"? And so it says, well, what does that mean? Well, in this relationship, you shall not eat the flesh of an animal. In other words, you shall not be like a dog, but you shall be holy. You will not act like a dog. You will not base your decisions on animal instincts. You are holy to me. In other words, there's a differentiation between, you know, what you would be as acting upon your own base instincts and what I am calling you to be, and that is distinct.
Well, it doesn't talk about not copying the dog's behavior. It's saying that you shouldn't give in to the instinctual drive at this time to eat this meat.
Well, that's right. What a dog does, he comes upon a carcass in the field, he doesn't give it a second thought, he just starts digging in. So, because it's available. And so, for us not to be compared to the actions of the dog, which our natural instincts would be, hey, there's fresh meat here on the ground that's just been killed, maybe I should just dig in.
Well, I agree with that idea. You shouldn't try to equate yourself to animals, but the question is, why is the command to give the meat to your dog in connection with when you find it in the field? Why not another case? I mean, why are we recalling that aspect of Egypt? it's disjointed. It doesn't... And there was a lot going on in Egypt. There was a lot in terms of at that moment. I'm just wondering if there's some sort of a connection between that moment as they were leaving.
There
shouldn't be.
Question is why does it have to specify that it's in the field? In other words,
that's just the
animal trait. But
that's just the way it is. They're just giving you the normal affair. The normal way the case would arise, the Torah is just depicting, that's all. Doesn't have to be literally. It could be, you find it in your garage. The same thing. But this is just the way. This is where you're going to find it.
Okay.
Put it in the field. Give it. You didn't mean just when you have an animal.
Rabbi.
Yeah. One second.
Did you reflect the fact that these laws were given to you after you left Egypt? Because you're saying, why hark back to this event? Well, all the laws in relation to were given at Mount Sinai 50 days after they left Egypt. And so that's why they're reflecting back to that event.
I don't see that. I mean, it's not, that's, if you think it's reflecting back when we get to the laws, then it should be reflecting on something that happened 50 days later when we got the law.
Well, it's to remind them that they got the laws after they left Egypt.
Oh, wow.
And, I'm just trying to go, why have this here about the dogs? Well, here we're talking about people fulfilling the laws. Well, when did they get the laws? After they left Egypt. So this is reminding them, you got the laws after you left Egypt, and
that's obvious. Of course we got the laws after Egypt. I mean, I don't think you need to have a command. You should remember that you got the laws after Egypt. I mean, no, that seems to be too obvious to me.
That's right.
Yeah. What happened? Let's stay with it. Give me one sec. Let me just think here. That was... Yeah.
It's interesting. I do see one thing. In the verse where it talks about it, it says in 11:7 that all the Jews, as they were leaving, the dogs did not bark, from man until beast. In order that you should know. Now, why? The verse tells us. In order that you should know that God distinguishes between Egypt and between Israel. God distinguishes between Egypt and Israel. God is making a miracle here. And it seems to be the verse that we have is telling us that you are a holy people, right? 22:30 says, opens up and says, a distinct people you are. I think we're starting to see an answer here, because you should give it to the dog, but this verse 30 is telling you, you are a distinct people. So, and the same thing God is saying in the verse where it says that the dogs didn't bark, because God is distinguishing. All right? So maybe we are at this point where we're not going to eat this animal. We know we can't. We're controlling our instincts. We should now recall that that is the objective of leaving Egypt. That was the objective of leaving. And that's why God was saving the Jews at that point. He was saving the Jews at that point. So fine. So what do you need the fact that the dogs don't bark? What more is that? I mean, I'm just saying the first step is that both cases it's talking about a distinction. You see it? Both cases, the verse, when we're told not to eat the meat but give it to the dog, it's because we're supposed to be a distinct people. When God didn't let the dogs bark at the Jews, so then he said he did that in order to distinguish them between the Egyptians and Israel. So he took the Jews out. He did one more thing to distinguish, but he distinguished in a very funny type of a way. He didn't let the dogs bark.
Well, Rabbi, isn't that the same as making sure that as time goes on, you know, the Jewish people do remember that the act of being delivered out of slavery from Egypt was not something they could have done on their own. In other words, that they depended upon the miracles of Hashem, so it's thrown in there that the dogs don't bark, which is almost in a sense saying, in case you were to forget, that it's not by your own hand that you delivered yourself out of Egypt, it's by my hand. He says it's the miraculous connection, that it's doing something that the dog, because if you take that portion out, someone could be led to believe, well, it was just through a natural course of events. You know, the Egyptian economy was beginning to fail anyway.
Well, you had 10 plagues. You had 10 miraculous plagues, and the last plague was inexplicable. We already knew that the Jews were being taken out by miracles.
Well, that's true, but doesn't the Rambam even say that the miracles were already set into motion anyway in Hashem's plan, so that when the seas parted, it was already pre-programmed in that
he
would part.
Yep, he says that.
But when you're dealing with a dog's basic instinct, their natural reaction is that the dog would bark, but it doesn't. You know, it's not. To me, that's a miracle. You know, the other ways, you know, the skeptics of the world regarding whether the Torah was of divine origin constantly try to show that these miracles really were simply a natural course of events.
Yeah, but come on, the splitting of the Red Sea.
I understand it.
The splitting of the Red Sea is much more of a miracle than a dog not barking.
Well, I think so, but you know, when you watch TV and you watch the Discovery Channel and they try to explain away the plagues as a natural event, they try to diminish or deny the sovereign hand of God in this whole thing.
Yeah, I have an easier time. I'd have an easier time with the dogs than explaining away the splitting of the sea at that precise moment that only the Jews got saved, not the Egyptians. It's too much. I don't know. Maybe we'll leave this as a question, and we'll give it some thought, and see if maybe we come up with something. But I think that the fact that we just noticed a parallel, that God's saying
in 2230 that you should be a distinct people. And then he also says that the reason why the dogs didn't bark was to distinguish them. All right, let's think about it. All right.
Do you have an answer next? You'll have an answer next week.
I have no way of telling you that. I hope I have one in the next half an hour. It's bothering me. All right. So we'll resume. We'll pick up with this question. Maybe we'll have it. If you guys have answers too, you know, as well. But we'll pick up next Sunday. We'll continue with this, and maybe we'll do a little bit more. We'll see where it goes. All right, we'll play by ear.
Thank you, Rabbi.
All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Rabbi.
My pleasure. All right, so have a good week, everybody. And we'll pick up on Sunday.
Thank you.
All righty.